Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Dan Proud. My pronouns are he, him, and his. I've been a member of Prairie for almost 20 years, and I'm on the board of directors. I'm the secretary. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted, open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, family structure, age, or abilities. During our virtual coffee hour at the end of the service, we invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so we can all get to know each other better. We also have joys and concerns that at that time, and we can break into small groups for more discussion and general chatting. We have a few announcements. We are sharing our offering this quarter with Allied Wellness Center. The Wellness Center is a neighborhood center with the purpose of promoting health and wellness of the mind, body, and spirit of people living in the Allied, Belmar, and Duns Marsh neighborhoods. Virtual Dungeons and Dragons, the beginners group, is meeting every Monday at 4:30 p.m., and the advanced group is every Friday at 4:30 p.m. Wednesday Fun Night this week is at 6 p.m. Next Saturday is at 10 o'clock, starting at 10 o'clock, is a car parade for Mary and John Frantz. This will be in front of Mary Mullen and Patty Stockdale's driveway. We also have some upcoming events. The retreat survey is due August 25th. That's coming right up. There's a form to fill out, which I believe has been emailed to people, the link to it. We'll have a modified retreat this year. We're not meeting at Bethel Horizons Retreat Center. That's been canceled for health reasons. So we'll be a virtual retreat in modified and shortened form. There's a Prairie Sing-Along, which is a weekly occurrence every Sunday at 7 p.m. Everyone is welcome to join us from 7 to 8:30. And the nice thing about it is nobody hears you singing. So it's led by one person and everyone sings along, but you can hear that person leading. So we use the Rise Up Singing songbook. Let Patty Stockdale know if you need a songbook and she'll get one to you. You can also buy it online. And everyone is encouraged to bring a song or two to request that we sing. And when you lead a song, if you want to lead a song, you can practice your guitar or other instrument or ukulele. And it's a great way to get practice doing that in a non-threatening environment. So, and it also brings out the folk rock star that you are. And kids are welcome and encouraged to join. And we can, there are lots of kids' songs that we can sing from the book. And invite your friends.
I'm going to
do this. Pardon me? Oh, okay. Barb Park will read our chalice lighting.
This is by Helen Hamilton Gardner. It is thought strange and particularly shocking by some people for a woman to question the absolute correctness of the Bible. She is supposed to be able to go through this world with her eyes shut and her mouth open wide enough to swallow Jonah and the Garden of Eden without making a wry face.
And now we'll have a moment of silent meditation. The story for all ages is Around America to Win the Vote by Mara Rockliffe. It's read by Robin Proud.
I'll just turn this. All right. So there was not a good recording online, so I'm going to read this, and I think we'll be able to see well enough. This is a true story, and I set out something. There's a lot, of course, there's been a lot of coverage in the last week of the anniversary, the centennial of women's suffrage. One of the articles from the New York Times featured some lesser known suffrage stories, including some from diverse backgrounds, but these women were actually mentioned in there. Just a moment. On April 6th, 1916, a little yellow car set out from New York City. It carried tools, spare parts, a teeny tiny typewriter, an itsy-bitsy sewing machine, one stout leather trunk bursting with useful things, two smiling women, and a wee black kitten with a yellow ribbon tied around its neck. The taller woman was Nell Richardson. The smaller one was Alice Burke. Together, they planned to drive all the way around America. It was a great big country, but they had a great big cause. Votes for women. They said the typewriter and sewing machine were part of the plan. If anyone said women didn't have the brains to vote, then Nell would dash a poem off right then and there to prove they did. If anyone said they should cook and sew and leave running the nation to men, then Nell would whip an apron up while Alice gave a speech to prove they could do both. And if the two of them could circle the United States 10,000 bumpy, muddy, unmapped miles, facing danger and adventure all alone with just each other and a kitten in their little yellow car, well, that would prove that women could do anything. So off they went. And if any of you saw a special one time narrated by Tom Hanks on PBS about the first man to drive across the country, this wasn't much later and there was no infrastructure to speak of. That very day they had their first adventure when a horse pulling a wagon down a narrow road refused to let them pass. Votes for women, Alice told the horse. Nell tied a votes for women yellow daffodil behind his ear. Then the horse stepped aside and let the little yellow car go on its way. In Philadelphia, they stood up on their seats to speak to the great city crowd. People cheered, but the next morning, blizzard! Nell and Alice dug into their trunk of useful things. They put on their raincoats and their rubber hats and drove through howling wind and swirling snow to Baltimore, where they arrived in time to be the guest of honor at a fancy party. The trunk held a few useful things for parties, too. The next day when they stopped for gas, a crowd of men clustered around the little yellow car. Alice hopped up on the seat to give her speech, but no one listened. So she told them all about the car instead. Votes for women, the men said, and waved as Nell and Alice drove away. After a quick visit to Washington, D.C., they came upon the bumpiest and muddiest road yet. The little yellow car went bump and squelch and finally got stuck. As the car sank, Nell and Alice jumped into the icy stream. They cranked and cranked the engine, but it wouldn't start. Votes for women, Nell reminded Alice cheeringly. Alice grumbled, and good roads. In the trunk, they found a lantern and a blanket and a box of candy from their friends. They huddled wet and shivering under the blanket and ate candy till the sun came up and two strong mules appeared to pull their car out of the mud. In Virginia, Nell and Alice passed a school, and all the children ran to see the little yellow car. They drove into North Carolina, passing fields of singing birds and butterflies and goldenrod, and nearly fell into a hole where a bridge used to be. Next came deep puddles, sticky clay, and thick, wet sand. In South Carolina, a whole town turned out and treated them to an all-yellow lunch. In Georgia, they joined a circus parade. In Alabama, they sipped tea and nibbled on stuffed dates. Everywhere they met crowds. Outside Gulfport, Mississippi, the little yellow car finally found a mud puddle it couldn't cross. So they had to take the train. They sneaked the kitten onto the train and smuggled it into a fine hotel in New Orleans. Then the little car arrived and they were on their way. They dodged bullets by the Rio Grande, drove on through the desert of New Mexico and got lost for days in Arizona. And finally, they reached California, where they won a medal at the fair for driving a long way to get there, all the way across America. But they were only halfway to the finish line. They still had lots of miles and lots of adventures to go. So you can see they took a southern route. And when they came back, they came through Wisconsin. On September 30th, 1916, a little yellow car drove into New York City. It carried mud and dust and signatures and souvenirs from all around America. Two smiling and sunburned women and a full-grown cat. They arrived to a grand welcome and a great big yellow cake. The cat ate 7 slices, as reported in the next morning's Tribune. After 10,000 bumpy, muddy, unmapped miles, Nell was ready for a rest. And Alice? She turned right around and crossed the country all over again. This time, she took the train. And that's our story.
Thank you, Robin. Well, we're excited to have Robin to speak again for us. Today she will present Helen Hamilton Gardner, Free Thinker and Suffragist. They preferred the term suffragist rather than suffragette. This presentation is related to our third principle, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. Robin has been my wife for a long time. We both went to Carleton College where we met. And she's been a UU for over 40 years and regularly speaks to UU groups and on topics from history, psychology, and literature. So please greet Robin.
Thank you. So I will give a little introduction and then I'll have some slides to show toward the middle part and then I'll be back on. The scandal was in all the newspapers. In 1876 in Sandusky, Ohio, the state commissioner of schools, a married man, was having an affair with the young and pretty principal of the teacher training school, Alice Chenoweth. Commissioner Charles Smart was supposed to be inspecting the school, but he always seemed to arrive on Friday afternoon after school was closed and leave by Monday morning. When the news got out, Alice was removed with the excuse of budget issues, while Charles was allowed to resign. But Alice, 23 years old, didn't spend the rest of her life hiding in shame. She moved away, changed her name to Helen Hamilton Gardner, and spent the rest of her life working for women's legal and social rights. And I'll have some slides here. And Helen Who, I had never heard of her in spite of reading a number of books from this era, and I have not yet found anyone else who has. Helen Hamilton Gardner was born as Alice Chenoweth in 1853 in Virginia, where the Chenoweths were a family of property. Oh, we could put the full screen. Her father, Alfred, a minister, decided he could no longer be a party to the institution of slavery. So when Alice was 1 year old in 1854, Alfred freed his slaves and moved his family to Washington, D.C., and later to Indiana. Alfred, the father, died when Alice was 11, and that same year, during the Civil War, 3 of her brothers were seriously wounded, and 2 of her grandparents died. There was very little wealth left, so various family members moved to Missouri and Kansas to run farms. Alice had no desire to farm or to get married, so at 19, she moved alone to Cincinnati to train as a teacher, one of the very few careers open to women. Once she began teaching in Sandusky, Alice was so outstanding that by age 23, she had been appointed principal of the teaching academy. This is when the shocking affair derailed her career, and she reinvented herself as Helen Hamilton Gardner. At some point, Charles Smart followed her. He had been allowed to resign quietly from his job. The couple lived in Detroit and later New York, where Charles pursued a mediocre career in insurance. Most biographical articles say that they married. I believe that Wikipedia says this, but the first full biography of this remarkable woman has just come out this year. In Freethinker, Sex, Suffrage, and the Extraordinary Life of Helen Hamilton Gardner, author Kimberly Hamlin states that there is no proof of a marriage, and there's even a question of whether Charles ever divorced his original wife. Helen, as she now called herself, and Charles lived as a married couple for decades, so everyone assumed that they were married. Her early experience led Helen to champion an end to the double standard. Men were allowed, even expected, to sow wild oats, and they were forgiven for many indiscretions, course, that would never happen now, right? Women, on the other hand, were taught that they must be absolutely pure. Current interpretations of the Bible back this view. Religion was also used to support the belief that man was the master of the household. This led Helen to be a freethinker in the mold of Robert Ingersoll, a famous speaker labeled the Great Agnostic. And here's something that Robert Ingersoll had to say about men and women. He had a speech called The Liberty of Man, Woman, and Child. He proclaimed his belief in the equality of women and the importance of egalitarian marriage. He decried stingy husbands, grumpy husbands, and husbands who acted as if they were the boss of their wives. Ingersoll also ventured to suggest that husbands got these pernicious ideas about marriage from an old book that taught that women were an afterthought of creation, taken from a man's rib to be his helper. As long as woman regards the Bible as the charter of her rights, Ingersoll thundered, she will be the slave of man. Well, Alice wrote to Ingersoll, attended his lectures, and became his protege. She was actually called Ingersoll in soprano and was a very successful speaker. By 1884, when she was 31, she was speaking in New York under the name Helen Hamilton Gardner. Hamilton and Gardner were the maiden names of two of her grandmothers, and the former claimed to be descended from Alexander Hamilton. We don't know why she chose Helen, but it means bright one or shining light in Greek, as well as being the name of a famous, beautiful woman. Critics remarked on this petite, ladylike figure proclaiming very radical ideas. Biographer Kimberly Hamlin writes, "The novelty of Gardner's lecture tour made national news, but most reviews focused on her looks, sometimes to the complete exclusion of her remarks. The Chicago Tribune, for example, provided extensive coverage of her hair before concluding, it is unnecessary to give a synopsis of her lecture." That would never happen today either, right? Among her lecture titles were Men, Women, and Gods, and Historical Facts and Theological Fictions. While there were other freethought speakers, she declared she spoke up specifically for the women. And here's a quote about that from the biography. "Church teachings," Gardner proclaimed, "denied that women were people with absolute rights of persons, including the right to control their own bodies. Crushing a woman's self-respect and destroying her sense of personal responsibility as to her own acts in the matter of chastity. From Bible verses and Sunday sermons, a woman learned that she must subordinate her own sense of right and her own judgment to the dictates of someone else, anyone else of the opposite sex." She said the Bible clouded women's thinking with stories about blessed virgins and the evils of women who craved knowledge. As an outspoken agnostic, Gardner rejected the creep of Christianity into American public life. In the 1880s, there was a surge in legislation proposing Sunday closing laws, Bibles in schools, and declarations that America was a Christian nation, and now it was creeping into the women's rights movement. She actually opposed temperance as an infringement on individual liberty. She thought that people could make their own choices in that regard. These sentiments separated Helen from a lot of the suffrage movement, which was avowedly Christian and which stressed the ladylike nature of its participants. And I'll read something from what she wrote about creeds, because some of us have been asked this question as UUs or freethinkers. "I'm sometimes asked, what do you propose to give in place of a comforting faith? It makes people so happy. You take away all this blessing and you give no other in its place. What is your creed?" It has never seemed to me that a creed was the staff of life. I should not object, however, to one that should read something like this. "I believe in honesty. I believe that a church has no right to teach what it does not know. I believe that a clean life and a tender heart are worth more to this world than all the faith and all the gods of time. I believe that this world needs all our best efforts and earnest endeavors 24 hours a day. I believe that if our labors were needed in another world, we should be in another world. So long as we are in this one, I believe in making the best and the most of the materials we have on hand." I believe that love for our fellow men is infinitely nobler, better, and more necessary than love for God. I believe that men, women, and children need our best thoughts, our tenderest consideration, and our earnest sympathy. I believe that God can get on just as well without any of these. If he wants anything, he can get it without our assistance. It is people with limitations, not gods without limitations, who need and should have our aid. I believe that it is better to build one happy home here than to invest in 1,000 churches, which deal with a hereafter. So that would be very courageous for many people to say today in the public sphere. And actually, in New York, Helen joined the Liberal Club, where, according to the New York Sun, no topic is forbidden and the talk is very free. The club hosted weekly speakers and debates. They celebrated the solstice and the birthday of Thomas Paine. So humanism as a belief had not been defined, but this really seems to be what her view was. Helen tried to enroll in classes at Columbia University, but women were only allowed in a few specialized courses. As a freethinker, Helen believed in using science to address world problems. But she found that science was being turned against women. Multiple books and essays by so-called scientists of the time claimed that women couldn't possibly equal men because their brains were physically smaller. These experts also insisted that too much study would render women infertile. You may remember that the astronomer Maria Mitchell had to fight the same ridiculous claim. Well, Hamilton Hamilton Gardner addressed these issues directly, demanding scientific proof. She even started an initiative for prominent women, such as Elizabeth Cady Stanton, to include in their wills that their brains could be preserved and measured after death. And she also developed a famous lecture called Sex in Brain. Helen wrote two very successful novels dealing with issues of the double standard and men's and women's place in society. At the age of 40, she delivered multiple major speeches at the Chicago World's Fair. And here's a picture of her around that time. And her speeches were so successful that she had them printed under the title Facts and Fictions of Life. She became co-editor of the magazine The Arena, a journal devoted to social causes. And at this time, one of her ardent concerns was raising the age of consent for girls who could be married off very young. Helen arranged for Charles, who was failing in his insurance career, to become business manager of the magazine. But within a year, this magazine, The Arena, failed. Not only that, but her husband, Charles Smart, and another manager were arrested for fraud relating to sale of stock in the magazine.
Say, Robin, sorry to interrupt. We're not seeing your screen. Can you?
Oh, no, I didn't do anything.
Can you try redoing your screen sharing?
Yeah, sorry. Just a second. Did that just change? Whoops, just a minute here.
You want to go to...
Huh. Oh, that's odd. We were on Helen for a while here. Okay, we're not really ready for this slide, though, but okay.
Whoop. Go back here.
Why is this not showing? There we go.
There you go.
Okay. Odd. Oh, thanks for letting me know. Let me go back a little bit here. Here. We'll get there in a minute. Okay, so she's over here. All right.
There we go.
All right. So after Helen's husband and a manager were arrested for fraud relating to stock from the magazine, they were acquitted, but it was a blow to Helen personally and professionally. By the next year, Charles began to suffer from dementia. He passed away in 1901. By the next year, Helen had remarried. Colonel Selden Day was someone she had met in conjunction with a very different book she had written. She had written a book about the Civil War based on stories of her own family. When they got married, Helen was near 50 and Day was over 60, but they did not retire to rocking chairs. Instead, they went on a world tour. They visited California, Hawaii, Japan, where they stayed nearly a year, then the Philippines, Malaysia, China, Ceylon, sailed up the Red Sea to Cairo, and here she is on a camel, on to Europe, where Helen met Buffalo Bill at the Wild West show and Chief Irontail. She was comparing head sizes. And there's one more picture from her trip. Here she is with another fighting woman, the statue of Joan of Arc in Paris. Helen and her husband ended up being away 3.5 years. They then settled in Washington, D.C. because Colonel Day wanted a warmer climate than New York. It turned out to be perfect for the next leg of Helen's life journey. Through her new husband and from her previous work, Helen had many contacts in D.C. She threw herself into work for women's suffrage. Now, at this time, there were several factions in the movement. If you watched the recent PBS special on the vote, you saw this conflict. Carrie Chapman Catt of Ripon, Wisconsin, was the leader of the main existing group and felt that they should work through channels. But a younger contingent led by Alice Paul was inspired by the tactics of British women, such as going on hunger strikes or chaining themselves to a fence. And they actually were some of the first people to have demonstrations outside the White House holding up signs day after day. Now here's Alice Paul with Helen. Well, Helen belonged to that more traditional group. She felt that aggressive action would make more enemies. For a long time, there were two groups, the National American Women's Suffrage Association, NAWSA, which was the established group under Carrie Chapman Catt, and the National Woman's Party, which was Alice Paul's new organization. And biographer Hamlin says something about the two women. For the first few months of 1913, Gardner had been energized by working alongside Paul, a young firebrand not unlike herself 30 years earlier. But long before the NAWSA leaders figured out that Paul posed a threat to the organization and its reputation, Gardner cooled relations and began to separate herself from Paul. Over time, Gardner positioned herself as the seasoned D.C. antidote to Paul's militant partisan upstart. Paul may well have been the smartest woman in America, as Gardner once characterized her. But Gardner stated that she was the one who had lobbying skills, life experiences, contact, and personal charms, all of which would be needed to secure the amendment. And this is not unique to this movement, right? Just about every movement has its split in questions of how aggressive to be, how demanding, how much to work within existing channels. Then there was one of Helen's accomplishments as an insider that we'll appreciate here was that she helped organize a reception for pro-suffrage politicians at the home of Senator Robert and his wife, Belle LaFollette, from Wisconsin, of course. And of course, the tricky part was that all the people who were to vote for women's suffrage were men. Then there was a split between those who favored a state-by-state plan versus a federal plan. Everyone knew that the southern states opposed extending the franchise in any way. That was because it would draw attention to the fact that after Reconstruction, they had established various means to keep black men from voting. Adding black women to the voters horrified them. And some of them even mentioned that black women would be a harder force to dominate, or it would look bad if they were seen roughing up black women as opposed to black men. Unfortunately, some activists, including Susan B. Anthony, used this split to drive the cost of women's suffrage. She said something about how it could be that black men, who she called Sambo, would have the vote and white women wouldn't. She also said the same thing about immigrants. So some people used this tactic. Wouldn't it be good to get white women enfranchised so they could support white men? Helen was a supporter of the national approach, which in a way, it went around this southern issue because of enough states from the rest of the country that would take care of it. So they needed Congress and the president to support them. Through letters and personal diplomacy, Helen became a regular at the White House and a visitor to President Wilson. And here she is with Carrie Chapman Catt after a White House meeting. So Helen is the shorter one there. When the U.S. entered World War I, women lobbied that they needed equal status in order to support the country in its time of need. And in fact, the Women's Suffrage Association organized a special committee, including Gardner, to coordinate women's war work with the government. After a lot of lobbying and negotiating, which of course you can read further about in many books, Congress passed the 19th Amendment in June 1919. And now I have this picture showing the vice president signing because this is when the Senate passed it. And this Helen is on the right. She had actually supplied the gold pen used for the signing. Most of the suffragists had not lived to see this event. The following year was devoted to getting 36 of the 48 states to ratify, with Wisconsin being the first, famously, and Tennessee dramatically the last. For an excellent recounting of the battle in Tennessee, there is a wonderful book called The Woman's Hour by Elaine Weiss. Helen requested that Wilson place a woman on the Peace Commission negotiating the end of World War I, but Wilson insisted other nations wouldn't accept that. However, he did decide to name a woman head of the Civil Service Commission. This was a post once held by Teddy Roosevelt, and he offered it to Helen Hamilton Gardner. This was the highest position a woman had attained in U.S. history so far. Helen was then 67 years old, but she threw herself into her new job and loved it. And I've got a little story from that that shows something of her attitude. When she went to the White House one day during President Harding's administration, his secretary said, "I went to the mat for you yesterday, Mrs. Gardner. A man undertook to tell me that you're nearly 70. But I said that if you're a day older than I am, and I'm 54, if you're a day older than I am, I eat my hat." To which Gardner replied, "Then prepare for a diet of felt." So she served for 5 years. She resigned just months before her death. And on her death, she stipulated that her brain be donated for the project she herself had started, and it resides at Cornell University today. And come back here. So Helen Hamilton Gardner spent as much time and energy on women's issues as anyone in the movement. She was present at the signing of the 19th Amendment. She held the highest government position for a woman in history at that time. Yet if you ask almost anyone about her, including me, before I read this book, the response would be, "Helen, who?" So we now have some time for questions or comments. Oh, do we need to see some of the early pictures? Let me go back here. Let me quickly, we have to share. We have to share. Yeah, hold on. Okay, all right. Somebody, so I didn't realize that some of these were not shown.
Yeah, we didn't see any until I interrupted you.
Oh, I'm so sorry. You should have interrupted me. I know it's hard to interrupt me sometimes.
I wasn't sure if you were having, if there was supposed to be a slideshow or not, sorry.
Oh, no, I must have missed. So here's an early picture of the aisle under the name of Alice. And this is the book that came out this year that's very readable. Robert Ingersoll, who some of you may know. And Helen Hamilton Gardner.
That's when they were talking about her
as a speaker. Yeah. Yes, she was called Ingersoll and Soprano.
Her hair.
Yes, when she was being reviewed for her hair and her dress and so on. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who she tried to get to give her brain, but her family did not like that idea. And here's Gardner. I think that's where we came in. Okay. All right. No, I'm sorry about that.
So anyone can go and mute yourself if you have a question.
I have a comment. This was an excellent presentation. Thank you so much. And I have another Helen for you. Helen Hoyt, H-O-Y-T. And also in 1916, there was an article called The Women's Number 3. And that was published in September 1916. Helen Hoyt was an author and a poet. And she was she wrote a poem about by the river, for example, "Wash me clean of my feelings, etc." And the Choral Arts Society Chorale commissioned a piece of music, a composition that was based on her "By the River." And she's a very well-known, not to me until recently, a very well-known poet regarding women's issues, Helen Hoyt. And I just wanted to throw up something on that. And again, thank you for such a great presentation.
Well, thank you for mentioning that. There are so many people that we haven't heard of.
So I'd like to jump in and talk about, you mentioned how some of the white women suffragists used anti-Black and anti-immigrant feeling to bolster their cause. And I think this is something like as somebody who grew up in the 70s, we didn't hear about this at all. This was really kept underground. And in this day and age, I really appreciate this embrace of what some people are calling intersectionality, the connectedness of all the different oppressions, and the need for us to not have our pet oppression that we care about, but rather look at this as one big picture. And I feel like it is so important that this history of racism within the women's movement be more told. So yeah. I'm really glad you raised it.
Yeah, thank you. The article I sent out from the New York Times mostly featured women of color of various backgrounds. The PBS special on The Vote, which if you didn't see it, you probably can get it from the PBS website because it was just shown in July. It talks about Ida B. Wells, who was a Black woman. There are many Black women's organizations fighting for the vote, even though they knew they'd be the last to actually achieve it. She was told to march literally at the back of the big suffrage parade, which she refused to do. And when you mentioned the 1970s, in the 1970s, many people in the women's movement did not want lesbians to be prominent because that would play into the stereotype that all women's libbers were a bunch of lesbians, and transgender wasn't even possible to consider. So, yeah, there have always been some of these decisions made that later on we question.
So, Robin? A couple of things. I'm starting to read the book by Dr. Carolyn Jefferson Jenkins, who was the first African-American woman elected the national president for the League of Women Voters, who was supposed to be our keynote speaker when we had to cancel everything in March. And some of the history that I had forgotten about, I had heard about, but I had completely forgotten about, was that in the 1840s and 50s, many of the women who were involved in the Seneca beginning of women's rights movement, they were also abolitionists, and they were very strong abolitionists. And they expected that when the abolitionists entered the 15th Amendment, that they would be including women as well as African Americans in the 15th Amendment. And that did not happen. And so it goes back to the 1850s when the women became very disillusioned that they who had fought so hard for the right to vote for African American males, that they were not included. And so it reminded me of that. And the other thing that the Women's Hour, which you talked about, the vote in Tennessee, that vote would not, in fact, in several of the border states, the 19th Amendment would not have been ratified if they had stressed anything to do with African American women, because the Southern states were so afraid of having a majority of African American voters. And so that became, the Southern states became the dominant, well, they were just enough of them to sway that. And so it was a very, very controversial kind of thing that was going on there in terms of the history and the society in that era and the people who were in charge at the state legislators, at late legislatures.
Yeah, no, that is a good point. Women like Susan B. Anthony felt they had been betrayed, that their they assumed that this suffrage would be extended to all at that time. And that was a whole, yeah, it was a whole concern that, that some people felt, well, black men were in the most danger of their lives if they were not able to vote. And something that has come up recently is that in a sense of some vestige of the three-fifths compromise still exists, that for many years, certainly until the Voting Rights Act and now newly again, that the areas of the South get representation based on the number of people living there. But if lots of black people can be discouraged from voting or stopped from voting in any way, the remaining white people have proportionally more power. So we are still living with many of these legacies.
Any other comments? Got quite quiet group today, I guess.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
We'll have closing words, which are written by Helen Hamilton Gardner, read by Barb Park.
When asked by the Washington Herald newspaper to answer the question, "Why am I a suffragist?" Helen replied, "Because I am an adult human unit who has not fortified the fundamental rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Forfeited, yeah. I knew that wasn't.